Best of friends, best of enemies. Well, if the CIA is running around the movie sets, I suppose that means the FSB, Six, Mossad, and a half a dozen other agencies are running around. And I'm wondering if some self-reliant individual shows up, you know, say a Caucasian shows up in the Middle East, does everybody in the neighborhood know immediately where the CIA office is? I'm just curious about stuff like that. I'm curious about stuff like the Bourne Identity that our guest tonight, Chase Brandon, consulted on. I'm interested to know if psyops like that go on in the real world. I'd like to know about the game show host in the movie Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. I want to know who points the tip of the spear. I want to know all these things, and I'm going to see if I can get a couple answers out of Chase Brandon tonight. Just see how good of an interrogator I am. I bet I'm not that good. We'll see. We'll see. This is Coast to Coast AM. Chase Brandon, one of the comments here on your book is war, the occult, violence, science, mathematics, cryptology, spies, soldiers, geniuses, and for seasoning, a dash of good old science fiction. You have served up a terrific intellectual stew about the eternal battle between good and evil. Bravo. Let's finish up real quick on In the Company of Spies and how I came the closest to being somewhat realistic. And then let's do this Bourne Identity, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, Charlie Wilson's war thing. I just want to get your take on stuff and just tell us what you can tell us and what you can't tell us, you can't tell us. But the thing about interviewing somebody like you, because you're clearly a very intelligent man, I'm not patronizing you either, it's obvious. I mean, this book... I figure your IQ on a bad day is double room temperature. You know what I mean? That's the old scale, 72. You know what I mean?
So, John, really, don't you imagine that anybody that was a fighting horned toad and went to TCU is above average?
Well, absolutely, positively.
Well, okay. Although,
so you do know something about Fort Worth, Texas?
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed because actually your feed is being run through an agency provided computer that I get to continue to use, even in my status. And so we've got a TLX 5000. And as I look at you, I really expected you would be wearing tonight a purple and white shirt with that little horned toad emblazoned on it, but you're not. And I think if you were a dyed in the wool TCU grad, you would be so attired.
Well, you know, it's just a momentary departure from my delusion of grandeur, which I understand purple denotes. But I got to tell you, I was thrilled when they won the Rose Bowl game a couple of years ago.
No, absolutely.
Because when I was there, I mean, you didn't even mention any of the sports teams.
No, no. Well, when I was there, Bob Lilly played. He went on, of course, being a great Cowboy.
Thank God I'm actually interviewing someone who may be slightly older than I am.
Yeah, oh, yeah, dude, really.
Yeah, I'll tell you, well, we certainly, in that regard, chewed a little bit of the same ground. But look, in a minute, I'm going to get a bunch of emails saying, Wells, this is a CIA shill, you know?
Yeah.
So help me out here. Let me ask you something before we get back into this movie thing. Everybody's heard that I saw a thing, one of my favorite television shows is a British thing called Spooks over there, and they call it MI5 over here.
Yeah.
And they were trying to put together a liaison, you know, a better relationship between the Brits and Russia. So they got very deep into the FSB guy there, and Harry Pierce, the director of MI5, says, okay, who killed John Kennedy? And the Russian guy says, the CIA and the Mafia. I thought everyone knew that. So I guess the question is, the rumors are that the CIA and John Kennedy were crossways with each other. They wanted to disband the agency. I don't know if that's true or not, but there seems to be some evidence to support that. And blah, blah, blah. So I guess the thing is I've always thought of CIA as the tip of the spear, and the spear is policy. And I just wonder, can you even speak to a consistency of policy irrespective of who happens to sit in the Oval Office?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. The consistency of the policy is that unlike every one of the other, I got Lord knows how many there are now, but, you know, 15, 16 members of the United States intelligence community, they all have stovepipe connections to the parent organization for whom they primarily serve. And if anybody could be involved in cooking intelligence, it's going to be one of those organizations that has a fixed chain of command. The CIA was designed by the National Security Act of 1947 to be an independent civilian organization that reported directly to the executive branch in general, to the sort of White House more particularly, and absolutely, in many regards, exclusively to the president. And the agency has done its job well enough over the 40-plus years that I've been associated with it to know that what Harry Truman said about the agency actually rings quite true as policy. And Harry Truman said, the damn CIA is like the skunk at a tea party. And what he meant by that was that a lot of times the pinstripes at State Department and the guys with stars and bars and what have you on their epaulets at DOD, they had a sense of what something was all about, Alfie, and they had a sense of where their respective organizations were going to go to deal with international problems having to do with national security that had bearing, obviously, on the White House and its role as the, you know, primary leader in the free world. And what the president needed always, and why the CIA was created, was when neither diplomacy was getting the job done, nor could U.S. boots be placed on the ground, there needed to be some interregnum measures that could be applied. And then the agency was it. We are the only organization in that alphabet soup of initial organizations that has the charter for covert action. And when we carry it out, we don't just make up where we're going or what we're going to do when we get there. There is a process called a presidential finding that consists of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board and the National Security Council and the Senate and the House Oversight Committees and all manner of other people. And that finding, when it judges that neither of the president's two normal options are available, that finding produces a directive, and the presidential directive orders the agency to conduct covert action. And those can be low-intensity conflict wars where we are supporting surrogates in Central America and Africa and Middle East and other parts of the world, and those projects have lethality attached to the presidential directive, and that's why we have drones flying around now, look down, shoot down. So, right. Yes, the agency plays some pretty hard ball, but it's always under the guidance of more regulators than you can imagine, starting with the Oval Office and running down through the Office of Budget Management and the Oversight Committees, the Attorney General's Office, and the agency's internal general counsel, and the agency's own ethical code and credo. And we're the most monitored rogue, or quote-unquote, organization right. there is. And we have got a pretty good track record of having followed rules and regulations. Let me tell you that part of covert action is propaganda, and propaganda is deliberate manipulation and misrepresentation and misdirection. That has to do with supporting certain political aspirants to gain a foothold to achieve office in countries where we would like them to see in power. It certainly involves supporting people in office who are trying to stave off the effects of an insurgency, which would cripple their country. It can, in some instances, within the same region on opposite side of a contiguous mountain chain, involve you putting a different hat on Tuesday, leaving the country where you're supporting the government in power trying to kill guerrillas, and travel over to the other country where you're supporting guerrillas who we'd love to see overthrow the country in power. All of those are policy-driven issues, and they don't come from the agency. They come from the 60,000-foot perspective, which, as a political force, presses down atmospherically on everything that happens at ground level. A whole bunch of stuff happens underground. That's the conspiratorial, Machiavellian, covert action world that the agency is in. And when we go down there to do the bidding of the political forces from on high, when we are successful, those who direct us have a success, and they get credit for it. When we do what we are instructed to do and we fail because it is a high risk venture, and anything that can go wrong, that Irish rascal Murphy will almost always guarantee can and often does go wrong. When we go wrong, we fail. That's called a flap. And it has something called blowback, and those are consequences. And the consequences are invariably to us, because we are the plausible deniability factor for all the people sitting up at the 60,000-foot level, sending the political pressures down.
Something goes right, nobody finds out about it. Something goes wrong, and it's you out on the clothesline.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Now, does that mean that we don't make mistakes? Of course we make mistakes. My God, it's a difficult undertaking to do what an organization like CIA does, and to do it within the context of rules and regulations that literally tie our hands behind our back, put blindfold over us, spin us around a bunch of times, get us dizzy from the sheer bureaucracy of it all, and then say, march quickly, stealthily, and successfully off and take care of business. And it's hard to do. So many things go wrong, and we always organizationally pay some kind of price for it. Look, do we have stupid people in the agency? People get in who shouldn't be there. Do we have corrupt people? Well, good Lord, we had Aldridge Ames, and we had Harold Nicholson, Eddie Lee Howard, who actually was one of my students down at the so-called farm. And the FBI had Hansen, and the military has had people, and the NSA has had people that have committed treason and espionage.
Look what the Brits had with McLean and Philby and all those guys back in the 50s and 60s.
It goes all the way back and includes the Brits. I mean,
yeah, Peter Wright said he thought it was Hollis, the director of MI5, that was the mole the whole time.
Well, look, a lot of people paid enormous prices for the treachery that Aldridge Ames was doing, because everybody was focused on the wrong people for the wrong reasons, and a lot of people failed to see how clearly complicit Ames was, and part of it was moving into a period of political correctness where you didn't want to speak harshly and be responsible for somebody not doing well, and he sort of got moved along from one assignment to the next, even though he was drinking and he lived beyond his means. And I mean, every signal in the world was there that he was doing something wrong, but the bottom didn't fall out of that cardboard box until Ames's treachery had resulted in a good dozen or more Soviet assets being killed by the KGB. So look, I mean, we have Goofy and Mickey Mouse that reach senior levels in our organization. Good Lord, we've got Goofy and Mickey Mouse running the country, some might say. So you can't account for personality types. But in the case of the agency, most people absolutely are dedicated, hardworking, and totally patriotic. And if we have a consistent policy, it is that we do our damnedest to get the job done. And we've done it year after year with less in the way of budget and less in the way of real support and more insane rules and regulations placed on us that fly in the face of common sense. And won't go into all of them, but
got to ask you something here now, because you, whenever you say something, and by the way, all of the wonderful and beloved listeners out there in Coastland, he's answering your questions if you listen closely. If you don't get it, it was not written that you would. But I've heard him answer several questions. Now, something that's on everybody's mind, because we are not operating on the same level of enlightenment that you are. We don't have an MI5 for internal and an MI6 for external, like James Bond. We have CIA and we have FBI. So is CIA domestic and foreign? And if they are, if that tip of that spear is directed toward the American people through things like the NDAA, is this going to cause another kind of conundrum, or will CIA just do what it's directed to do, regardless of who it's directed to?
No, look, the agency's mission is to deal with the FI target. FI is foreign intelligence. So people in foreign countries, governments that have some sort of internal within their own country activities that are deemed to represent threats to us, foreign governments and militaries that by virtue of their regional hegemony or attempt to impose their will on neighbors run the risk of destabilizing, you know, that is a threat. Bad people that, you know, are growing, processing, and transshipping hundreds of tons of narcotics to the United States and smuggling weapons to the United States. You know, these are all on the operational directive list as assigned to the agency through that broad government-wide mechanism called the regulatory control over CIA and the rest of the intelligence community. So when we're focused out there, over there, abroad, on FI targets, we're where we're supposed to be. John, and listeners to this program, when bad people pack up and come to this country to fly planes in our buildings and release sarin gas and anthrax and blow themselves up or leave packs in public places and cars to blow people up, that is a foreign intelligence threat that has come to the United States. It alone makes it the priority of our internal service, if you will, our national police, if you will, which is the FBI. Because the FBI's job is to do what? Gather chain of evidence, make arrests, have prosecutions, put people in jail. Okay? They are the prime in that world of terrorism, drug trafficking, whatever that's happening in the United States. But it's a foreign intelligence issue, and it's still in the operational directive and bailiwick of CIA. So we can still operate here against that target. We do it in collaboration with the FBI. Part of the problem is everyone surely must have gleaned from following the press in the wake of 9/11. Part of the problem about why so many things fell between so many cracks and why you had the likes of congressional leadership excoriating Louis Freeh and George Tenet over failure to communicate and coordinate and cooperate. Good Lord, that was exclusively because those same people on the other side of the microphones railing against the FBI and the CIA leadership, those same people had created the laws that federally forbid CIA.
Hang on, we got a break. Hard break. This is Coast to Coast AM. Stand by. More. Well, thank you very much. We're talking with Chase Brandon tonight. His book is Kryptos Conundrum, a very well-written, very riveting plan to be in the pages for a while kind of a book. And we'll make sure you know where to get it very shortly when we continue our discussion with him. Are there basements at the CIA headquarters building or special training sites like the farm? Is that a real thing? The covert staging center? You wrote about his book where the Roswell crash cadavers were said to be stored in cryogenic tanks. We're getting there, and we got a ways to go. Hour and a half, we're going to use it, too. Coast to Coast AM, we'll be back. Chase Brandon, you were saying that the reason it was basically such a cluster foxtrot is because communication skills weren't everything that they could be between the agencies and all of the various entities up there in D.C., which begs the question, is spycraft like very high tech these days, even, you know, almost, over 10 years on, since the 9/11 thing, or is it still, you know, like dead drops for notes and chalk marks, you know?
Yeah, well, John, a couple of things you've raised. One, the communications, failure to communicate was certainly an issue. Many of the self-imposed constraints that the congressional folks, legislators had placed into effect were looked at, evaluated, altered in the wake of 9/11. A lot of changes, Homeland Security, Transportation Security Agency, a creation of an Office of Director of National Intelligence to coordinate, promote communicative coordination. Those were all fantastic improvements. Patriot Act giving opportunity to carry out consequential activities to safeguard people in this country from foreign people who were here to harm us. All of those things have been massive improvements. The proof, unfortunately, you can't find because you can't locate the pudding wherein it is, which is hard to prove negatives. It's hard to point out successes when, by their very successful nature, stopping things before they happened and then having it not become public knowledge because it wasn't leaked and we didn't give up the slight advantage we had. All of that has improved somewhat. It's not a perfect working environment. We still have people who, for all manner of self-serving, self-aggrandizing reasons, personal political gain as opposed to statesmanship, will say and do things that may produce one set of positive results for that 60,000 foot level, but it substantially cripples, undermines, and puts other people's lives in peril because we talk about stuff we shouldn't be talking about. And all that still goes on. And I don't know if there's any way anymore in an era when nothing can be nor is kept secret, which is distinct from the kind of secret keeping that worked better in the old days when we had a different socio-cultural environment and something like a Roswell, something like whatever the truth is behind the Kennedy assassination. I, for one, don't believe Lee Harvey Oswald with a clunky Mannlicher rifle in the Texas Book Depository, fired off those rounds. Moreover, I have a very good friend that I hunt with and fish with in Texas, and he has an older, he's a doctor, my friend, and my friend has an older doctor, mentor of him, who was the attending physician in the emergency room at Baylor Hospital. And I have sat around the fireplace at the Hunting Lodge in Texas and listened to the very distinguished elder doctor, still performing emergency room work, incidentally. He was there, and he and the other doctor were working on the first gurney that rolled in. The doctor standing in front was saying, "We've got a major opening here in the throat," and he's proceeding to give the medical forensics about the nature of the wound. And the doctor that I know, quite older, distinguished man now, as I said, still practicing, he said, "Don't bother. This man has no rear skull." And that was Kennedy. And my doctor friend said the small hole in front was not the exit wound. If anything, it was one of several, perhaps, entrance wounds. The rounds came out the back of the skull. That's what makes the exploded exit of a cartridge designed to move mass. And Kennedy had no back of his head. He didn't get shot from the rear, at least not his head, as near as anybody with any common sense can tell. So,
well, I don't know if you heard the broadcast, but they're right there at the end of that bridge, that balustrade that goes across the main Elm Commerce Bridge, terminated in a little surround where you could set up patio furniture, except for the open hatch in the floor, which went down to the storm drains. And if you came out of that storm drain with a rifle on your shoulder and looked right over that balustrade, that car was headed right directly for you at exactly where the Zapruder film puts it.
Absolutely.
I saw it myself.
So the bottom line here is what? There's a hell of a lot more at the subterranean Machiavellian twisted root level than there is at the 60,000-foot, political equity level. So what does that mean? Well, it means that all the information hasn't been revealed. Something that has been kept secret has managed to be kept a secret. And there's some kind of conspiracy. Well, I don't know what that is, but I certainly believe there is one. I also absolutely know, as I sit here talking to you, that there was a craft from beyond this world that crashed at Roswell, that the military picked up remains of not just the wreckage, but cadavers. And all of that was made public for a short while. And then when the War Department, this was before the Pentagon and the Department of Defense existed, but it was some 18 hours later when people back up in Washington thought about what had been said and admitted to, said, this isn't going to work. And the balloon thing came in, and the big general came in, and all the people who were down at Roswell suddenly were transferred. And this thing went into cold storage. And why has it stayed that way? Well, it stayed that way because back then, people like Mac Brazel and Sheriff Wilcox and everybody else that knew what they knew because they had seen what they saw and smelled what they smelled with the decaying cadavers, they all bought into the notion that when the government says don't talk, you don't talk. And when the government implies that it can bring pressures to bear if you do talk, and they explain to you what those are, people with any degree of sense and concern about their family's well-being and their financial nature and their property and everything else, they shut up and they don't say anything. And then the passage of time takes care of most of it because it sort of went away until many, many years later, and it underwent that miraculous revitalization. And, now everybody knows about Roswell, and everybody is torn between the evidence provided by the government that it was weather balloons and other evidence that people continue to find and dredge up that says, no, damn it, something really amazing happened there. And in all of it, the way the Air Force handled it early on when the FBI was involved, the CIA's involvement to include a study done on the UFOs published in our own studies in intelligence, internal CIA publication, which actually it was done in an unclassified form. A lot of that talks about the perception of reality, the misdirection of other people's perception by suggesting new realities. It's propaganda. It's Machiavellian. Everything that we deal with in the world of intelligence and everything we deal with that has high levels of political sensitivity with potential blowback from the flaps that occur, it's all orchestrated. Nothing is as it seems in the world of intelligence. Nothing is as it appears to be in the criminal world where everybody's trying to make a living by skirting the law.
Sure.
Things aren't as they seem in the world driven by ideologies that want to, you know, kill themselves in order to kill us. And the public is left somewhere in that middle ground, getting squeezed from the political equity pressures from on high and the manipulation that's occurring underground beneath their feet. And the agency does play a part in propaganda. It's part of the presidential finding for covert action, for Pete's sake.
Tell me if I'm off base here, but it sounds to me like what I take from this myself is that if a serious situation is created at the political level, the higher political level, the CIA may not necessarily know about it. I'm not sure if that's even a cool thing to say, but might as well. I mean, stuff's blowing up all over the world. So what's the big deal? It sounds to me like if something is orchestrated up there among the politicians and the big money and so forth, then CIA would still be in a position of executing whatever the policy that was set, but they wouldn't necessarily know who, what, or ultimately even why, would they?
Yeah, look, I think all you have to do is listen to how you worded your own premise, and that is, in a world exclusively CIA, where everything operates on need-to-know and compartmentation, and the agency, CIA, is one organization within a far broader, larger, complex federal government structure, it stands to reason that political cliques, political organizations, elements within different government agencies, apart from the intelligence community, all have agendas, and they all have people that gather. There are little cliques and little cabals, and Lord knows what all goes on. I don't know. It's always beyond my pay grade. But can stuff like that happen? Yeah, I mean, I think it probably can. I think it's virtually impossible anymore, and has been now for a long time, maybe the last, you know, 15 or more years, to really keep secrets. I mean, you know, Watergate was the first big showing of to what lengths everybody would go to try to out somebody else and get the real story, and Woodard and all the rest of the journalists created a new standard of excellence on the one.
And I don't understand why they're not making a big deal out of Holder, because this seems to me more serious than that.
No, I can't even go there for many reasons. One is I couldn't speak coherently and rationally. I would I can't.
I have trouble with that too.
But let me tell you how it is that something like Roswell has remained truly a conundrum, cannot be figured out one way or the other, is that at this point, there's really not anybody left that actually knows anything. And that which is known, honestly, it is lost somewhere in the literal closing scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, when the Ark of the Covenant goes into that government warehouse, and as far as you can see, it's nothing but crates. And let me tell you how and why that can happen. First of all, I have seen inside, not a crate, but I have seen inside a box in the agency, and it has me know, surely as I'm sitting here talking to you, that all of this business with Roswell is real. I mean, it really happened, and I'll get to that. But when I came on board, the agency was still buried. Its building was back there in the deep, dark woods, and The building was all broken down into compartments, and you couldn't walk down certain corridors because there were turnstiles and security guards, and you had to have certain letters on your badge, and things were sent around by a pneumatic tube, and cafeteria was divided between the overt population and the clandestine service people serving at headquarters between their overseas tours. They couldn't eat together, and you know, hardly had any real communication with one another. And the building had not computers. They didn't exist. It didn't even have only a handful of electric typewriters because they had only come out. Most of the building had Remington Royal manual typewriters. There were no Xerox machines because they didn't exist. There were mimeograph machines, and there were big, clunky green metal desks and filing cabinets, and everything was in folders and boxes. And the tail end of the OSS crowd, all these little blue-haired ladies in tennis shoes were the historical memory, and they ran everything. And, you know, I showed up, and I was a young recruit, and you know, there I am doing training, and I've got my obligatory startup period at headquarters, and everybody sat at a different desk because everybody was mobile. If you were in the clandestine service, you were just there until your next temporary duty overseas or your next what's called a PCS, a permanent change of station, two- or three-year tour overseas. So you didn't have an office. You had, you know, these desks and filing cabinets and crap. And I remember at a number of different desks, you know, because I've always been curious. That's, you ask what we look for with agency people, an inherent curiosity to explore and learn. The whole list of stuff, we've kind of gone beyond that now. I won't go back. But I had that curiosity. So what did I do? I opened desk drawers. And what did I find in there? Things that had been pouched in from our overseas facilities. And what were those things? Well, among other things, guns, counterfeit money, bogus passports, and all manner of other really interesting stuff. Little box with a desiccated, mummified finger in it. Pieces of paper that with scribbled on it about what some of this stuff was. It had faded because it was written on onion skin paper with sloppy ink pens or pencils, and all that stuff had gotten old and faded out from all the way back to the OSS days. And so here's all this stuff. And when the agency started moving into the new era, the wall came down the cafeteria and the turnstiles came down, and the analysts could talk to the clandestine service people and they could talk to the analyst, and the old desks were going to be moved out, and cubicles were going to be built and wooden furniture brought in, and the Remington Selectric typewriters proliferated, and then the first word processors started showing up. And, you know, it's been like the hastening ever since, just racing forward into the ultimate Peter principle. Well, what happened to all of the stuff in those desks? Somebody came along and said, okay, dump everything out of all these desks. They're all going to be taken down and thrown into the dumpster dumpsters and hauled off for trash. And so we got to make sure there's nothing in the desks or any of these filing cabinets. John, I can't tell you the number of times that filing cabinets turned in go to the Government Services Administration, GSA. They put them up for auction, and companies, businesses, warehouses, you know, whoever needs filing cabinets, to include safes, four-drawer heavy safes, they come in and they bid on auction lots for all this equipment. You know how?
Got to hold you right there. I'm sorry, Chase. This is a bad time to break, but we got to do it, or they'll just cut us off. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back for.